Welcome to the Filibuster, the podcast of the Union University Political Science Department. The Senate filibusters the right to unlimited debate. Because of this, some people call the Senate the world's greatest deliberative body. But unlike the Senate filibuster, we will place a limit on our discussion, but we still hope to be a forum of civil debate and discussion of major issues from our academic, political, and Christian perspectives. My name is Sean Evans, and I am the host of today's broadcast. And our guest today is Seth Brake, our international relations instructor here at Union. Welcome, Seth.
Thank you so much.
All right. President Trump has declared peace in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas. In fact, he said the war in Gaza is over. It's over, right? So Earlier this year in one of our podcasts, you said the Middle East was easier to solve than the Ukraine.
That's right.
Do you still believe that?
I do.
Okay.
I think the evidence bears it out because we saw Trump try his negotiating tactic on both conflicts, and we have a ceasefire in one place and we have an intensification in the other. So I think I've been a little bit vindicated there.
Okay. So you think that... So tell me about this peace plan. How did we get here?
Well, we have Trump's unique form of diplomacy. We have the form of diplomacy where Trump relies on his personal connections with others. So we saw his close relationship with Netanyahu. We saw his embrace of the more aggressive Israeli tactics. We saw the United States actually joining in on a bombing campaign against Iran. With any other president, you would see this and you would think that this is the alignment of the U.S. with Israeli interests. But this is Trump we're talking about. He doesn't align with anything.
Himself.
That's right. That's right. And he works closely with Netanyahu until he doesn't. And now we have this situation where he has sort of boxed Israel out of the negotiation process of the end of the ceasefire and the governance of Gaza. So in terms of how we got here through a two-year-long brutal war where Israel incessantly attacked Hamas and Hamas fought back, and a war that, of course, Hamas started on October 7th, don't leave that out. But Israel was fought to a standstill in Gaza, and then Trump came in and he made these diplomatic rounds over and over again. Sometimes he made a fool of himself, sometimes other people made a fool of themselves, but at the end of the process, the fighting has stopped, and that's something that's worth talking about.
Okay, so what are the major components of this 20-point peace plan?
So the 20-point peace plan is public, it's out there, you can go read it. It begins with what we've already seen, a ceasefire followed by prisoner exchange. And that's gone through. We have had all the remaining living hostages have been released, and many Israeli prisoners have been released back to Gaza. But then, and this is where it gets really interesting, is that the plan calls for disarming Hamas, which was Israel's war aim, actually, which is interesting. Probably will not be accomplished in the way described here. But, and this is the thing that I was most scratching my head about with this plan, is the plan calls for a independent board to be set up to govern Palestine. And this board it's described as technocratic in the document, so it's going to be made up of area experts. It supposedly wants to have qualified Palestinians and international experts is the term. It's going to be called the Board of Peace at first. And this board is going to exist to govern Gaza until the Palestinian Authority has completed reforms. And these reforms, there's actually, the plan gives a multiple choice outcome for different ways those reforms could be conducted, but somehow or another, this international board is going to govern Gaza itself. And the most interesting thing about it to me is that this document also names who the chair of that board is going to be. And it's going to be Donald Trump. Not the President of the United States, but Donald Trump specifically is going to be the chair of this board.
Well, it's not just that. The things I've heard is most people actually think Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister, is actually going to be the one who will run it.
So he's mentioned in the document as well.
Yeah.
The other members and heads of state to be announced, including former Prime Minister Tony Blair. So yeah, Tony Blair is going to have a guaranteed seat on the board. Donald Trump is going to be the chair of the board. And then the rest are going to be technocratic area experts.
Okay, so tell me, what's different about this plan compared to previous plans?
Well, this plan is outside administration. This plan is an international organization running Gaza. This is something that we have. I mean, the thing that this reminds me most of is the UN Trusteeship Council for Former Colonies. This is not democracy. This is not home rule. This is an international organization directly governing a small nation. And I say small nation because the other very interesting thing about this document is at the very end, it recommits to the two-state solution. So this document brings U.S. policy back in line with the two-state solution and has gotten many countries to sign on to it, including ostensibly Israel. So the two-state solution is back on the menu, sort of, but that state is going to be governed by an international board to begin with, which is complicated.
But this is a step-by-step-by-step plan.
Of course it is, yeah.
So what are the chances that we'll get to the step of a two-state solution?
That's the really complicated part, right? And this is why I think I'm a little bit more positive in my outlook on this than I think many people are, because the fundamental problem with something like a two-state solution, and actually the fundamental problem with peace at all between Hamas and Israel, or even Gaza and the Palestinians who live in Gaza and Israel, is that both countries are faced with what we call a commitment problem. So it is very difficult to imagine, even if the leader of Israel wanted peace, it is very difficult to imagine them committing to that peace. And in the same way, as long as, well, actually, it's very difficult to imagine whoever's in charge of Gaza, be it Hamas or the Palestinian Authority or some other group, it's very difficult to imagine them being able to commit to peace with Israel because their interests are so opposite.
Okay, but hasn't the PLO committed to peace with Israel? I mean, the problem isn't committing to peace per se, is it? Is it finding a way to govern effectively?
Well, I think it is committing to peace, especially in this case, because things are different now. You have factions in the Israeli politics, on the Israeli side, who are ideologically committed to, I think, what you would call ethnic cleansing in Palestine. And in the same way, you have very powerful factions now in the Palestinian community who are ideologically committed to the ethnic cleansing of Israel. And in the past, you had more leeway in it. First of all, you had you had more secular leadership in both countries. In the past, you had more credible outside stakeholders. And I think now, between those two parties, there's no way you could write a deal that you would ever believe either side could keep to, and even if they want to keep to it. And that's what I want to stress here. I'm not trying to say that Netanyahu has some evil plan to destroy Gaza. I think that his hands are tied by domestic Israeli politics. And this is why, you know, this plan seems outlandish, but it has the skeleton of what an actual solution would look like, because it's external. And the people who are making the decisions about how this is going to work are the United States and the Arab states, countries who have more of an interest in the conflict ending than either party in the conflict itself. And I think that's the interesting thing here. It's a way of taking the decision-making out of the hands of the people who, for basic reasons of game theory, can't commit to making peace with each other. Now, I understand what you're saying. It's the long-term prospects here that are more difficult, right? But I think this is the internationalization of the decision-making, and that's the element that, even if the plan may not work in this form, that's the element that I think has something useful here.
Okay, but that raises some questions with this. Okay, first of all, there's going to be a rebuilding process.
Yes, that's the part we skipped over.
Who's going to give the money for it?
Well, I don't know who's going to give the money, but I think Trump thinks he's going to make some of it.
Well, of course, but...
the discussion here... So, the item 10 of the plan talks about a Trump economic development plan to rebuild and energize Gaza. And he's expect... And so he says he will have a panel of experts who helped birth some of the thriving modern miracle cities in the Middle East. So he's thinking that this is going to make money. I think that's the idea here. As far as who's going to actually pay for it, I mean, that's what they're deciding right now. That's what they're trying to figure out. But I think what Trump's vision for this is that international corporations are going to try and make a buck off of this and provide the funding themselves.
Okay, so, all right, so he wants to make some money, but
yes.
Part of this also is, is delivering the money, but it's also securing the peace. So there's supposed to be a international security force.
Yep, the ISF, the International Stabilization Force.
That's going to make sure that Israel and Hamas don't start shooting at each other. Now,
you've hit on the trickiest part.
Now, name one leader who's going to say, yeah, I'll send my troops to Gaza.
It is a real challenge. So item 15 of the plan suggests that the ISF is initially going to be primarily a training organization. They're going to train Palestinians here. It's hard to imagine. It's probably going to be some kind of foreign occupation if they can find someone to do it. And I really don't know who's going to step up to do that. I assume that's the bulk of what's being discussed behind closed doors at things like the big conference in Egypt earlier this week. Trying to figure out who would be willing to commit to that. Because, you know, in the Arab world, there is some cultural and soft power advantage to being seen as a stabilizing force for the protection of the Palestinians, right? If this could be a way that a country could credibly provide protection for the Palestinians without fighting Israel, that might be a way to gain some power in the Arab world.
But how does that happen? Because, you know, Hamas, they're already trying to reassert
their
dominance in Gaza.
Yeah, there's been fighting in Gaza recently.
They're going to use the any international security force as a potential threat to them.
Yeah.
So are Arab countries going to commit to shooting other Arabs?
Well, I don't think they would mind shooting other Arabs. Hamas has not made a lot of friends lately. But it is dangerous. I mean, I think the bigger threat here would be that you're going to be sending your own people home dead, right? That's the fighting. Fighting Hamas is very dangerous. This is what we've
right.
What everyone knows now. And so that is a huge challenge. However, we're talking about removing the IDF and replacing them with a more credible with a force that could theoretically be more trusted by the local population. So I don't know how you politically convince a country to try that. But if someone does step up to it, it is something that is more likely to succeed than IDF occupation.
Okay, and really, does Israel want to remain in Gaza?
So this is the most interesting thing about this, is how much what Israel wants doesn't seem to matter in this plan. Because Israel doesn't want to remain in Gaza, but Israel doesn't want to surrender Gaza either. Israel is in a no-win situation, and they have been since the war became a stalemate. Which is absolutely fascinating because, you know, this war had several small conflicts, right? We had Israel fighting with Hezbollah, we had Israel fighting with Iran, and we had Israel fighting with Yemen, all at the same time as they were fighting in Gaza. And they completely gutted Hezbollah. I mean, Hezbollah has lost all of their ability to fight. Yemen, it was a missile exchange and a bombing exchange. They weren't actually a serious competitor in that, but they haven't changed things much. But the most fascinating thing is just how much they rendered Iran toothless in all this. After losing their proxy in Hezbollah, Iran, really all they had left was long-range missiles, and they launched a lot of them, and many of them got through. They did expose weaknesses in the Iron Dome system and things like that, but when Israel counterstruck, they had air superiority over a powerful foreign country, and that is shocking. The level of damage that they were able to do to Iranian facilities and missile launching places and missile manufacturing places and things like that was incredible. And then, to follow it all up, the United States followed up with that massive strike on the nuclear complex. Which, you know, people debate about how effective it was, but I think as a demonstration, the effect just can't be exaggerated. You can hit stuff. That's the without taking anything back. So Israel won all of the surrounding conflicts in this, and then they were fought to a stalemate in the one right in their backyard. And so the context of that leaves us in this weird position where Israel is undoubtedly stronger right now than they were at the beginning of the conflict because their rivals are down, but they still could get nothing that they wanted out of Gaza. And so being stuck there, and now it's been years, and remember, as we talked about when we first had our podcast about this conflict, Israel's not made for long engagements. Their military is made for short engagements. They have conscripts. This dragging on for 2 years is really bad for them. It was hard on their military, it was hard on their economy, it was hard on their politics, and I know a lot of people liked to, especially at the beginning of the conflict, but even to now, like to see this as try and read a little bit too much into the domestic politics of Netanyahu's support coalition, saying, well, he wants the war to go on longer so he can stay in power. I think now we see the limits of that theory. Obviously, the war has been destructive and difficult for them politically. And so I think they just needed it to end at this point. They needed the hostages home. They needed the war over. Now, obviously, they would have wanted to achieve their war aims, and they were unable to do so, but they just needed the war over. So, yeah, they're giving up a lot politically with this deal.
Okay, so basically you're saying it wasn't a win for Israel, and it mm-hmm. wasn't a win for Hamas.
That's right.
Though Israel is coming out a bit stronger for this.
Quite a lot stronger in every other area.
Quite stronger. That Iran is down, mm-hmm. Gaza for the people in mm-hmm. Gaza. I guess we have to be thankful that the fighting is...
Oh, absolutely. I mean...
Not over, but reduced.
Well, no, I mean, the bombings have stopped. The casualties in Gaza are horrible to contemplate. I mean, and it's a densely packed area. So many people died in that conflict, because it's urban warfare where the refugees have nowhere to go. You know, again, in other conflicts in the world, when the war comes to your city, the people leave the city, right? In Gaza, the people can't leave the city. The people, well, you know, you can go out to a tent encampment nearby, right? But it's totally different. So that's why we saw these, you know, almost 100,000 civilian casualties, or 100,000 casualties at this point. I mean, that is, you know, it the human toll of this is devastating enough that any cessation of these hostilities is something we should be celebrating.
Yeah, of course. So when I look at this, one of the things that fascinates me is, who were the major players in this? Mm-hmm. Historically, when we're looking at Israel making deals with Arabs, we're looking at like the large nations.
Yes.
Like Egypt or Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me the biggest player here were the Gulf states.
That's right.
In particular, Qatar.
Yes.
So what? How did they get in the position to be so influential on this?
Well, Qatar in particular has positioned themselves as the deal maker in the Middle East. They allowed for a while Hamas to have an outpost there where people could talk to them, right, for the purposes of negotiation. They're the ones who will talk to Iran and Saudi Arabia and the United States, right? They wanted to be that big in-between, and that's exactly the kind of player that Trump likes. Right, and the Gulf states, we have incredible amounts of wealth. They're the mm-hmm. ones who can credibly follow up on Trump promises, like we're going to develop this area. So I think that these are actors who are uniquely suited to work in the Trump era, and that's what we have going here. On top of that, we have, of course, the changes in the politics of the Middle East at large. The Palestinian cause is no longer the mobilizing factor it used to be in Middle Eastern politics. And you know, we talked a little bit about how being seen as a protector of Palestinians might be something that's good for an Arab state right now, but that used to be the main cause that mobilized people, right? And the fact that that's weaker, I think, it shows, is evident by the way this is going. So yeah, we have the Arab states, we have the 20 to 30 nations that are gathering together to talk to Trump on this. What's interesting is how much Iran doesn't matter right now. They wanted to be one of the major players in this conflict, and they got knocked out. And then Russia's busy. They can't be the deal maker they want to be in the Middle East. And the United States is not really in this. It's Donald Trump that's in this, and that's the final interesting point here. So we have these players. We have the role that they're playing. And now Israel and Gaza have been reduced to the two fighting characters that everybody else makes a decision about. Again, I think it is extremely meaningful that Trump is keeping Israel out of the decision-making process for what's going to happen in Gaza there.
Okay, so let's talk about this. You said Trump's very transactional.
Yes.
So what is it that Trump did that's different from other presidents who have sought peace in the Middle East?
Well, one is just how unpredictable he is. You might have said that he is the most pro-Israel president we've ever had, because he does not care what Netanyahu does, and he'll. They occasionally had fake peace talks with Hamas so that Israel could get better targeting information on where Hamas leaders were. Like he authorized U.S. bombing of Iran to help Israel in their war. Right, like it's hard to imagine a more direct approach to helping Israel, but then he strong-arms Netanyahu into accepting this deal. He's a president who doesn't have allies, and I think that's the this emphasis on short-term deal-making is what makes a deal like this possible. It also raises questions about long-term sustainability. You wouldn't want to have a deal like this set up your alliance with the United States or govern your alliance with the United States, but if your preference is for short-term gains, this is exactly the kind of leadership you need. And maybe short-term gains are, I mean, this is the whole Trump approach to politics. Personalism, short-term over long-term, and then transaction. And we see all of this at play here. It's his personal relationship with these leaders that allows him to negotiate things like this. His transactionalism allows him to completely forget things like alliances and details and stuff like that. And then his focus on the short term over the long term, well, actually, it's even more than that. He focuses on the specific point of the announcement. That's what he wants. So when it came time to negotiate this deal, the Arab states had actually not signed on to it yet when Trump announced it. They wanted to make a few more changes. They wanted the details to be kept quiet. Trump goes on to Truth Social. He tweets, well, or not tweets, he truths that we have this deal, here's how it works, these are the points, and what are you going to do at that point? You have to agree with it, right? Because what Trump does is he announces victory, then he figures out how they're going to do it. And that's what he does here. So I said short-term, that's not it at all. It's specific point. He wants the point of victory, and everything else is details after that. That's the Trump strategy, and I think we might see the one case where it worked.
Okay, because what you're saying is he's more concerned about the public relations than the substance.
Well, I do think the timing was partially because he was hoping to get it in before the deadline on the Nobel Prize, which he did not get. But the public thing is part of it. I think it's a little bit more than that now, though. You know, he put himself as the head of the board, right? I think, as strange as this is to say, I think we are in the part of the Trump presidency where he's thinking about legacy. Now, it's legacy in that he wants people to be reading these 20 points in history books. He wants them posted in, you know, whatever he has that's like a presidential, in his presidential library, which he's now getting donations for, right? He is about that, but I think it's not quite the same as, he's not watching polls on this, I guess is what I'm saying. It's not motivated by electoral concerns anymore. It's fame. I think he's after glory.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, I look at a lot of his domestic agenda, and it's clear he's trying to make sure that he's a president who's remembered in the history books for something other than two impeachments, possibly three, depending upon what the congressional midterm elections turn out. So
right.
I see that. All right, so you said the key things for him is that he is personalist, he's transactional, and he's short-term.
That's right.
Is there a historical analog to someone who has the same type characteristics and have had success long-term?
Well, I think for me, and I've said this a few times in our podcast now, I keep going back to Nixon. I think that Trump is a slightly less civically minded Richard Nixon.
But wasn't Nixon long-term focused when it came to foreign policy?
I actually don't know if that's quite how I would characterize it.
Okay.
He made his decisions based on who he could form personal relationships with. And he saw through... He saw alliances as somewhat meaningless in the long term, right? It was more about, like, for I think that the pivot to China is the most clear thing here, where Nixon was able to, well, through Kissinger, right? But he was able to do things that violated the norms of American practice and understanding and even ideological policy for short-term advantages. I mean, the pivot to China was not to establish a long-term relationship with China. It was to get out of Vietnam.
Wasn't it also to separate China from the Soviet Union?
Yes.
To potentially be a counter against...
That might have been what Kissinger Soviet was thinking. Union. But I think Nixon was about Southeast Asia there.
Okay.
Yeah, I could be wrong.
All right. So we're looking at small steps.
Yeah.
We're looking at these kinds of things. What does anything that we've seen, what does this say is next potentially for the Abraham Accords?
You know, that's I'm glad you brought that up, because there is an important sense in which this is just Trump trying to come back to that priority from his first term. Because, again, he's working with the Arab states on this and the Gulf states, and the one of the things that they're discussing is the normalization of their relationship with Israel. All these countries want to fix the relationship with Israel. And this is part of a path to get there. What the war did, and of course the purpose of the war as well, was to drive a wedge between that developing connection between Israel and these states. Well, now the war might be over. And the Arab states have all become stakeholders in the peace now, maybe. So, you know, if the plan works, obviously, which it may not, right? But, so I think we're back on track toward those priorities of establishing relationships between the Arab states and the Gulf Arab states in particular in Israel. So I think that's back.
Okay, so how should we think about what's going on in the Middle East from a Christian perspective?
Yeah, I think there's a few temptations we ought to avoid.
Okay.
The first one is, you know, I respect the nation of Israel. I think that as a democracy, that makes them a good example to other countries in the Middle East. I think as a place that protects a lot of civil and individual liberties, that's a valuable thing. But I do think occasionally as Christians we get distracted. We want to treat Israel as something more than a country like that, you know, because of, obviously, I mean, Israel is the place where the founders of our faith had their ministry. Israel's mm-hmm. the place where the patriarchs went. Israel's the name of one of the patriarchs, right? You know, those connections are real and important, but what that doesn't mean is that we as Christians have an obligation to support Israel when Israel sins, right? Throughout Israel's history in the Bible, Israel very often is opposed to God. During those times, it is not necessarily righteous to side with the unrighteousness that Israel does. And I think that's the perspective that we have to avoid. And we can't think, this country has the name Israel, therefore we have to support everything it does. We don't. Israel is another country in the international system, and sometimes it's a good ally, and sometimes it's not. And this is the first error I think we want to avoid. Now, this isn't me saying we ought to oppose Israel. There's nothing special about Israel. There is something special about Israel. God has used Israel in his divine plan in very important ways, in ways that ought to be respected, but that doesn't mean Israel can't do anything wrong. The second thing that I think we ought to talk about here is we don't want to downplay the suffering of anyone involved in this. As Christians, we know that the people on both sides of this conflict are made in God's image. And when we make the mistake of treating a foreign conflict as something that American domestic politics need to be mapped onto, we find ourselves in some, frankly, evil positions. Like the people who are willing to downplay the atrocities committed on October 7th, 2 years ago, because they see Israel as a force that needs to be opposed. That's evil. The people who want to downplay the suffering of the Palestinian people, saying that their suffering doesn't matter because of the October 7th attacks. That's also an evil impulse that we have to resist as Christians. We need to see the humanity of the people on both sides and celebrate every day that people aren't dying. I mean, that's something that we have to recognize and we have to talk about. And then the final thing is that we need to view peacemaking in its proper context. First of all, not every peace is peacemaking. The type of peace that leads to more violence, the type of peace that leads to evil and injustice, these are things that aren't true peacemaking, right? True peacemaking, well, first of all, the most fundamental peacemaking is the peacemaking between man and God. That is the spread of the gospel, right? But the type of peacemaking that we need to celebrate and think about is the type that can lead to long-term flourishing and the spread of the gospel and human and more human outcomes, right? People doing better, people living better, people pursuing what is good, right? And I do think there's a path toward that in this document, but we're not there yet just because a ceasefire has been signed. So we need to celebrate that. We need to be excited that people aren't dying, but recognize that true peacemaking has to go further than that. True peacemaking has to improve the lives of the people there, has to lead to a better future, and promote the spread of the gospel. And that's the thing that I think we need to be aiming at. So we need to treat this with tentative excitement, but not say that the peacemaking has been done. So I think as Christians, those are the three things I would keep in mind.
Okay, well, that sounds great. So we've talked a lot about what's going on in the Middle East so far. Is there anything else that you would like to add that we haven't discussed?
Yeah. It's not at all clear to me what this means for U.S. involvement. We have not solved the Red Sea problem. The Red Sea shipping is still under threat, and that's something that is fundamental to U.S. interests. The fact that the war in Ukraine is getting worse, not better, means that in some ways, if this ceasefire does lead to an end to this conflict, we will no longer have to be diverting weapons from NATO and Ukraine to the Middle East, so that could be good for that. But on the same time, this also, it's just not entirely clear to me how what effects this will have on that conflict. And I think that's something we need to watch really closely, because where Russia can focus its attention, what that means for what it does with its resources is something we need to watch. And then, of course, we also have the things are getting a little bit worse in Central Asia, with the conflict between Pakistan and Afghanistan, for example, but also just the overall involvement of China in these things is something that we shouldn't lose sight of. I've always thought, especially in the last 20 years, politics in the Middle East has a way of distracting U.S. foreign policy from the things that are more central. This could be really good for allowing the U.S. to focus on the areas that matter more to central U.S. goals, but at the same time, if we end up trying to rebuild Gaza and now maybe even having to defend Gaza, that could get a lot more complicated. So these are things, it's just a lot of question marks here for me about what this all means.
All right. Well, I guess this means that we'll have many more opportunities to discuss
you find a silver lining to every cloud.
The Middle East, Trump foreign policy, and more.
Yeah, but I do recommend that everybody read the 20-point plan. It's been posted everywhere because this is part of the discussion. They're trying to make that really public. If you are interested about these things, you can read it and then track whether or not these things happen. So.
All right. Well, yeah. Good. Well, thank you for speaking with us today. And with that, I will yield back the balance of my time.